Erev Tov on the Erev Shavuot. Nice to see everybody. It's a pleasure to welcome Rebecca Winter Gottlieb. As I mentioned, we go back before she was born. Rebecca grew up in Toronto, Canada, so we know that place well. She learned at Midrashet Lindenbaum, Matan, Stern's graduate program for advanced Talmud studies. And she taught Tanakh and Gemara in Toronto and Atlanta. And she has a PhD in clinical neuropsychology, and she's working in private practice in neuropsychological assessment, and also serves on the faculty of the Atlantic Jewish Academy. And it's a pleasure to welcome her back. She's spoken a number of times before. And Rebecca also, she didn't put it in her bio, but she represented Canada in Chidon HaTanakh many years ago, and then would coach people at Netivot to help them prepare for Chidon HaTanakh. So, bavakasha, Rebecca.
Thank you so, so much. It's so good to be here. Just hang on a second. One of my sons.
You should come. Come for the shear. Bring him in for the shear. Yeah, yeah, of course.
But it's great to see everybody here. I know it's Erev Shavuot, so it's difficult to pull away and peel yourselves away from preparation. So it's just so nice to see those who were able to come out. And I feel very fortunate because I'm able to give this shiur before Shavuot, of course, talking about Parsha Bamidbar, which everyone likes to point out. It really should be called Bimidbar. And we're not sure why we call it Bamidbar, but that's how we refer to it, Parsha Bamidbar. And Parsha Bamidbar is really an exciting parsha because it's kind of the koteret, or like the introductory parsha, for the entire Sefer Bamidbar. And while I say it is exciting, I do remember being in elementary school, kind of coming into grade 6 at Netivot HaTorah, for those of you who are familiar with the school, and we start learning Sefer Bamidbar in grade 6, and we were all very excited, like finished learning about Vayikra, and then we get into Sefer Bamidbar, which we know is full of all these exciting stories about the spies and Korach, and only to be very disappointed and this like enormous letdown when we opened Sefer Bamidbar, and lo and behold, it was this like really monotonous, dry parsha about the formation of Bnei Israel around the Mishkan. So that was always, you know, like a real letdown for us students. But I think, and I do think that there's a lot to be learned from Parsha Bamidbar, and I hope we'll explore some of it together today. One, a couple of aspects of it today. I'm going to share my screen, if that's okay, Rabbi Kalman. Oh, I think am I able to share my screen?
You are now. I'm sorry. I forgot to make you co-host. You are able now. We're schmoozing too much.
I know. That's the problem. Always a problem. Okay. Excellent. So I'm going to share my screen. And I think these sources are shared or will be posted. So there's, so for those of you who'd like to follow along at home or download from Torah in Motion's website, feel free. But I want to start off with the Ramban and Nachmanides and his introduction to Sefer Bamidbar. And the Ramban, of course, for those who are familiar, he launches an introduction to each of Chamisha Chumshei Torah, and he really gives this overarching thesis to each one of the Sfarim. And in Sefer Shmot, he famously calls it Sefer Galut V'Ge'ulah, so this beautiful overarching theme of our redemption, not just our redemption from Mitzrayim, but really being the formation of a nation, receiving the Torah, and he outlines this beautiful theme in his introduction. Famously, he calls Vayikra Torat Kohanim, so all the different mitzvot that pertain to the Kohanim and the Mishkan, and that's really kind of the thesis and the central idea of Sefer Vayikra. But then in Sefer Bamidbar, there seems to be this breakdown, at least for the Ramban, of giving a cohesive or coherent message of the Sefer. So I just pulled some of it because the Ramban is quite wordy and he kind of expounds quite a bit, but I just brought a little bit of it. And what he says is, V'hasefer hazeh kula mitzvot sha'ah. The entire Sefer is comprised of mitzvot, of commandments that are timely, meaning that are timely, they're only meant for the period of the time that Bnei Israel were in the desert. And then just a couple lines later, He says, "Ve'ein b'sefer hazeh mitzvot nohagot l'dorot zulati k'tzat mitzvot be'inyanei hakorbanot sheitchil bahem b'sefer hakohanim ve'lo nishlam bi'uran sham v'hishlimo b'sefer zeh." So he says, well, we don't really hear about mitzvot l'dorot, meaning mitzvot that continue for generations, that we have to keep for generations to come, except for a few that really should have been included in Sefer Vayikra, but they kind of slipped their way in somehow to Sefer Bamidbar, and we're just kind of filling them in here in Sefer Bamidbar. So I always found this really interesting, because clearly the Ramban is almost grappling with finding a real central theme of Sefer Bamidbar. It seems like there's these mitzvot that kind of snuck in from Sefer Vayikra to Sefer Bamidbar, which really leaves us with more of a question than an answer of why are those mitzvot, what are they doing here in Sefer Bamidbar at all? And this confusion around Sefer Bamidbar is really very beautifully highlighted by Rav Shimon Klein, who writes for Virtual Beit Midrash. And he says that if we think about the central themes of the last three books of Chumash, Vayikra, Bamidbar, Dvarim, it's very clear that in Sefer Vayikra, we have this Torah Kohanim, as the Ramban explains, right? Vayikra el Moshe, Vayidaber Hashem elav me'ohel mo'ed lemar, that Hashem calls to Moshe and he calls to him from ohel mo'ed. And that just continues. The entire book is being told from this perspective of the Mishkan, of the tabernacle, of this holy place. And that is a theme that maintains and that's consistent throughout Sefer Vayikra. Sefer Dvarim is very different. Eile ha-dvarim asher diber Moshe el kol Yisrael ve'ever ha-yarden Bamidbar, Ba'arava, etc., right? Sefer Dvarim is really where we're on the precipice. We're about to enter into Eretz Yisrael. And so the location and the place that we're talking, that Hashem is talking to Moshe from, or that Moshe is speaking to us rather from, is from the Midbar right before we're going into Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, the majority of Sefer Dvarim is really about mitzvot hatzliyot ba'aretz, how we are going to act and how we're going to become a nation once we get into Eretz Yisrael. Says Rav Klein that what's interesting is that Bamidbar, the first pasuk, again presents us with this almost confusion. Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe b'midbar Sinai, that he speaks to Moshe in Midbar Sinai, which is this, the name of the Sefer Bamidbar, be'ohel mo'ed, but also in ohel mo'ed. And it kind of gives us both of these motifs, right? That it's in between Sefer Vayikra and Sefer Dvarim, where on one hand, Hashem is speaking in Sefer Bamidbar from the ohel mo'ed, from the Mishkan, but also it's important for Sefer Bamidbar to point out that we are inside the desert, that we're, it's not just that we're like in Sefer Vayikra in this siloed Mishkan, but rather now we also need to pay attention to something larger, which is the desert. And, I didn't realize I highlighted that. And if we think about Sefer Bamidbar and we think about the themes that are presented in Sefer Bamidbar, many Parshanim and many scholars today really point out this dual nature of Sefer Bamidbar. That on one hand, the first 10 prakim of Sefer Bamidbar are really about this creating this order, counting and the arrangements of the Shvatim, which is very much our Parsha that we'll get into. And then those leftovers, as the Ramban talks about from Sefer Vayikra, the mitzvah of Sota, Nazir, the menorah, Pesach Sheni, the Chatzotzrot, the trumpets, right? So those kinds of mitzvot that help us create some order. And then on the other hand, the latter prakim are really about these very interesting and oftentimes very sad, depressing stories of how really the failures of Bnei Israel as a nation in the Midbar. The Mitonanim, the complainers, the spies, Korach, Bilam, Moab, and Pinchas, Moshe hitting the rock, and we can go on and on. And Erica Brown points this out very much in her book, and she actually gave the very beautiful shiur a few years ago through Torah in Motion in 929, and you can go and watch it. It's on Torah in Motion's website too. A little plug for you, Rabbi Kalman. And, but she really talks about this dual nature of the Sefer, that the early parts of the Sefer are really about creating this order. And the later parts of the Sefer show how there was like a breakdown in this order and a breakdown in the nation. And of course, the transition from that order to that chaos, we could say, are these two psukim with the upside down nunim, the upside down nuns, Vayhi bin Saharan, Vayomer Moshe. And that right after that, we have this kind of transition from the order at the beginning of Bamidbar to that chaos and that complaining that starts to happen at the end of Bamidbar. And I brought in a quote from Erica Brown's book because I thought it was really very nice. She says, the first section of Numbers offers organizational methods for entering transitions and negotiating them successfully, but leaders can never prepare for what is inherently unpredictable. We will spend time with the Israelites in her book as they put infrastructure into place to help them negotiate the immensity of a harsh and unforgiving landscape. We will try to understand why over-preparing for uncertainty rather than surrendering to it was a costly mistake then and can be a costly mistake for leaders now. Okay, so what she kind of, her thesis is that we were almost over-prepared at the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar, and then there was this breakdown because we were, the leaders and us, we were inflexible almost to the landscape, to the harshness of the Midbar, and also inflexible to just the inherent qualities of human beings and the mistakes that they may make. And so Sefer Bamidbar, it starts off very nicely with this order, as Dr. Brown points out. And that's really coming off of Sefer Vayikra, which was very successful in imposing a very specific order on Bnei Yisrael. And we might call this theme the narrow successive order, meaning that Sefer Vayikra really is about creating very, very clear order within a very narrow context of the Mishkan. So we learn about the laws of Korbanot, we learn about the Chanukat HaMishkan, even the narratives, which are very few in Sefer Vayikra, are really about the mistakes that are made within the context of this order, and they're quickly blotted out and they're quickly reprimanded, right? Nadav and Avihu are quickly punished. We have the story of the Megadeth, the person who curses, and he's quickly punished and taken care of. So we really are narrowly focused on the Mishkan, and order is highly, highly successful in Sefer Vayikra. And however, if we move to Sefer Bamidbar, what we notice is that we're in Parshat Bamidbar, we're trying to impose an order, and Parshat Bamidbar is really very much about how Bnei Yisrael camped, specifically camped, and how many of them there were around the Mishkan, which looks incredibly orderly if we look at it over here, right? But at the same time, we are, like Erica Brown was saying, we're grappling with the uncertainties of the Midbar. And I want to add something else, which is that I think I've heard a lot of people talk about the development of Bnei Yisrael through this almost developmental model, that early on in Sefer Shemot, Bnei Yisrael are really in their infancy, and they really are highly, highly dependent on Hashem for everything that they need. And then when they move into Sefer Vayikra, they're children, meaning that we establish the Mishkan as the center and as the focal point of Am Yisrael in Sefer Vayikra, but we're so close to Hashem, everybody is right around the Mishkan. Everybody is right there. The entire Sefer is really focused on Hashem attending to us through the closeness of the Mishkan. But once we get to Sefer Bamidbar, we enter this adolescent stage, which is much more fraught, which is much more contentious, as we all maybe remember from our not so long ago adolescence, and where we are around the Mishkan, but we're not immediately next to the Mishkan, meaning the Mishkan, or maybe Hashem as our parents, is in our midst, but we are able to go back and forth. We have a little bit more independence. But of course, as we enter into this phase of life, our past kind of starts to catch up with us, right? No adolescent is without their history. No nation is without its history. And so what I'd like to do today is really discuss and talk about how, in Parsha Bamidbar, while it's primarily, and we'll go through it, while it's primarily about imposing a very clear order, instead of thinking like Dr. Brown, that there's a very rapid and abrupt shift from the order to the chaos, to the chaotic stories, I want to think about Parsha Bamidbar as introducing us to some chaos that actually lies beneath the order that's presented so beautifully in Parsha Bamidbar. And just like the adolescent child who kind of carries some of that weight with them, we as a nation are carrying some baggage with us as well. And in many ways, the order that's being imposed upon us in Parsha Bamidbar is just kind of hiding what's really beneath the surface and what's almost brewing beneath the surface, which means that it's unsurprising after 10 chapters of order that this would kind of bubble up. And so Parsha Bamidbar, if we think about it, Parsha Bamidbar is really divided into these major themes of really establishing clear order in Bnei Israel. First, we are introduced to the Nisi'im. We count all of Bnei Israel, and you can see in the image here each of their numbers. We understand why the Levi'im were excluded and why they get a separate count. Then we understand how Bnei Israel are beautifully arranged around the Mishkan. We have the detailing of the Avodah of the Levi'im and their counting by families. And finally, the idea that the Mishkan is really the center of the traveling camp in Israel. So when we look at Parsha Bamidbar on its face, there really doesn't seem to be anything beyond the order that we talked about, the order of those first 10 prakim. It's so prevalent in Parsha Bamidbar. But I'd like to dig a little bit beneath the surface together. And we're going to talk about three different situations, which I think really are really just lying beneath the surface of Parsha Bamidbar. The first situation is the situation which occurs at the end of Parsha Bamidbar in Perek Gimel, when Hashem describes how he's going to replace the Bechor, the firstborn, with the Levi'im. So why don't we read this together? Vayidaber Hashem al Moshe le'mor, v'ani hine lakachti et ha-Levi'im mitoch b'nei Yisrael, tachat kol Bechor petarechem mibnei Yisrael v'hayu li ha-Levi'im. And so Hashem says, I'm going to take the Levi'im from Bnei Israel, and I'm going to take them in place of the firstborn of Bnei Israel, and they will be for me. Presumably the firstborns were initially for Hashem, and then the Levi'im are going to be replacing the Bechor. Why? Ki li kol Bechor b'yom hakoti kol Bechor b'eretz Mitzrayim, hikdashti li kol Bechor b'Yisrael, ma'adam ad-behema li yiyu ani Hashem. So Hashem doesn't explain why he's actually replacing the Bechor with the Levi'im. Instead, he says, why is the Bechor important to me? Because when I smote Mitzrayim, when I gave them Makah Bechora, then I established the Bechor. I saved the Bechor of Bnei Israel, and I established the Bechor as sacred to me. And of course, we remember this from Sefer Shmot. He says in Pasuk Yudalad, Vahayaki Shachabin Chamachar Lemor, Mazot, Amartela, Vachosek Yad Hatsiana Hashem Mitzrayim, Yibet Avadim, Vahi Kihiksha Parala Shalchenu, Vaharav Hashem Kol Bechor Beretz Mitzrayim, Yibachor Adam, Vad Bechor Behema, Al Kanani Zaveach Hashem Kol Petarechem Hatsharim, Bechor Bechor Banai Efte. Right, so, this idea of the Bechor becomes very, very sacred and very, very special in Bnei Israel, especially during the time of Yetziat Mitzrayim, because the Bechor serves as this reminder of the very last plague, Makat Bechorot, of Bnei Israel. And we're reminded, of course, every single year in Pesach, when the Bechor has to fast, Ta'anit Bechorot, we're reminded of this miracle every year. And so for some reason, though, in our Parsha, Hashem says that the Levi is going to come to replace the Bechor. Now, the Ramban, Nachmanides, he explains that this was always the plan, meaning that the Bechor was always, always supposed to be sacred to Hashem only in the first generation of Bnei Yisrael, the ones who were immediately adjacent to Malkat Bechora. But then the Levi was always supposed to step in place of the Bechor and serve Hashem in place of the Bechor. So according to the Ramban, this is just something that happens. And this is really this instance, this situation is very much in line with the order being imposed in Parshat Bamidbar. How do we construct a very orderly and very coherent camp? Rashi, though, takes a very different approach. And what does he say? I'll read the end of the Rashi that's highlighted, that's underlined. Lefi shehaita ha'avodah b'bchorot, ukeshachatu be'egel nifsalu, b'halevi'im shelov du avodah zara nivcharu tachtehem. Says Rashi, a very famous Rashi, what's going on here? This is a bidyeved situation. It was always supposed to be that the Bechor was supposed to represent each family in Bnei Yisrael to serve Hashem. But because the Bechor, the firstborn, was part of Ched HaEgel, then Hashem said, well, I'm going to replace the Bechor with the tribe that stood up in Ched HaEgel, Mila Hashem Eli. When Moshe says, who is for Hashem, come to me, and all of Shevet Levi joined Hashem, then the Levi'im replaced the Bechor. And so according to Rashi, and Rav Alex Israel puts this so nicely, I'll read what he says. Rashi informs us that prior to the Egel, the firstborns were the priests. What does that mean spiritually and sociologically? It means that each and every family had access, had a representative in the temple, in the Mishkan. The spiritual heights of the temple were not restricted by an elite group serving from behind closed doors. Prior to the Egel, every family put forward a candidate for divine service. There was a certain democratic strain that enlivened this system. Meaning, according to Rev Alex's interpretation of Rashi, and I think that there's something to this for sure, that initially the idea was that we were going to be a more egalitarian society, and each of us was going to have a family representative that would serve in the Mishkan, that would leave the house and go close to Hashem, close to that middle piece in the Mishkan, and then come back to us and bring some of that spirituality back to each family. However, bidyeved, secondarily, because of Ched HaEgel, we now move to a system that's less democratic, and that's much more about having an elite class, an elite representation of a tribe that's going to take on that role that was initially supposed to be egalitarian. Now, this, as you can imagine, would cause some strife within Bnei Yisrael, right? Bringing up Ched HaEgel, bringing up this whole situation where the Bechor was supposed to serve, and now Hashem is mentioning that the Bechor is being usurped almost, the Bechor is being replaced by Shevet Levi. That has got to at least irk some families in some way. And I want to hold that in the back of our minds as we move on to the second example. So that's example number one, where Parshat Bamidbar kind of sneaks in this replacement of the Bechor, which could, we can imagine, cause some tension within Bnei Yisrael. Situation number two is a more personal situation that comes up in Sefer Bamidbar, in Parshat Bamidbar, and it really has to do with when we start counting the Levi'im. The Levi'im were not counted as part of the initial counts of Bnei Yisrael, presumably because they weren't Yotzei Tzava, they weren't part of the army, and they were counted separately by family because they were in service of the Mishkan. And in the introduction to counting the Levi'im, and this is in Perek Gimel, the beginning of Perek Gimel, I believe, it says, Ve'ela toldot Aaronu Moshe, b'yom diber Hashem Moshe b'har Sinai. This is the line, or this is the legacy of Aaron and Moshe. Ve'ela shmo b'nei Aharon, ha'bechor Nadav v'avihu Elazar v'itamar. Ela shmo b'nei Aharon, ha'kohanim, ha'mishruchim, asher milei adam l'kahen. So these are the names of Aaron. And so the obvious question that, of course, all the Parshanim jump on is, well, it says that these are the generations of Aaron and Moshe. This is the lineage of Aaron and Moshe. But we only see and we only mention the children of Aharon, which, of course, invokes the very famous Rashi on this pasuk in Perek Gimel pasuk Aleph of Bamidbar, and he says, and all teachers all really love this Rashi, Ve'eino mazkir ela bnei Aharon v'nikru'u toldot Moshe. Why? These are, it says, the offsprings of Aaron, but it's about the toldot of Moshe. Why? Lefisha lindan Torah, because Moshe taught them Torah. Milamed shekol hamilamed et ben chaviro Torah ma'ale alav hakatuv ki'ilu yalda. Anybody who teaches the son of his friend Torah, it's as if he is his own child. And so, you know, teachers love that. My students are like my children. That's a beautiful thought. It's a beautiful thing. But what it really is happening here, you know, what Rashi is really saying almost belies really the point of what's going on. Moshe had to give up a tremendous amount as a leader, as a family man, excuse me, to be the leader of Bnei Yisrael. And if we think all the way back to Sefer Shemot, Perek Dalet, when Moshe is on his way back from Midian, going back to Mitzrayim, going back to Egypt to go serve as Hashem wanted him to, and he has his whole family with him and they stop over at this inn. They have a strange encounter with God and they do a quick brit milah, quick circumcision on their son. And after that, Moshe continues alone to Mitzrayim, leaving the rest of his family behind, presumably to go back to their home in Midian. And only after many years of Moshe being in Mitzrayim and doing the Makot and Yitziat Mitzrayim and Bnei Yisrael going into the desert, only at Matan Torah in Parsha Yitro, when Yitro, his father-in-law, brings the family back, is there this reunion of Moshe and his family. And so that's just one example where Moshe really had to forego a real lasting relationship almost with his children for a long period of time in order to take on a role of leadership for himself. And I think in Parshat Bamidbar, there's a hint to this, that yes, it's true that Moshe was the teacher of perhaps the children of Aaron, at least according to Rashi, but deliberately or tellingly leaving out Moshe's sons really highlights the sacrifice that Moshe had to make in order to be the leader of Bnei Israel. So example number two is that this parsha, in a subversive way, explains to us something about some family complications that were going on for Moshe at least. So keep that in mind, all right? I'm asking you to keep a lot in mind. Situation number three, I think, is the least obvious, but also one of the most interesting situations to come up in Parshat Bamidbar. And it happens at the very early stage of Parshat Bamidbar, right when Hashem is explaining how Bnei Israel should be camped around the Mishkan. And the Pasuk says, this is Bamidbar, Perek Bet, Pasuk Bet, Ish al diglo be'otot levet avotam yachanu Bnei Israel. So every man should be camped with his standard, with his flag, Levet Avotam, according to their ancestral home, according to the house of their fathers, Mineget Zavid Lo'ohem Moed Yachanu, and they're all going to camp around Ohem Moed. Now, most Parshanim right away start thinking, oh, this is a great place to be a Parshan. I'm going to describe what the different Galim represented, right? So Yehuda gets one and Reuven gets one, and each one represents this kind of personality of each Shevet. Interestingly, Bamidbar Rabbah has a very, very different approach to these words, specifically, Ish al diglo levet avotam. Every man for his flag, according to the house of his father. And I'd like to read this together. I gave a brief English translation, but I'll read it in Hebrew and translate as I go. It says Bamidbar Rabba, the Midrash, which is the Midrash on Sefer Bamidbar, Lo hayat zarich lomar ela ish al diglo be'otot yachanu bnei Yisrael. The pasuk only had to say that each man should stand according to his degel, according to his flag. Ma Talmud lomar levet avotam. Why do we also need the words levet avotam? According to Bamidbar Rabba, this is redundant. If we say each man is standing on his flag, obviously each flag represents your ancestral home. There's no need for us to say levet avotam. Ah, so then a beautiful midrash, I think. that Bamidbar Rava is bringing. It says, "B'sha'a she'amar," I'm just skipping a little, "B'sha'a she'amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'Moshe, asa otam zgalim k'mo she'nitavu, itchil Moshe matzer." So as soon as Hashem says to Moshe, they should be standing in this specific order, Moshe starts to panic. He becomes distressed. Why is he distressed? He says, "Amar achshav atida hamachloket lehinaten ben hashvatim." Now, Hashem, you're really starting the machloket ben hashvatim. You're really starting the strife, these arguments between the shvatim. Im ani omer l'shivto shel Yehuda, if I say that to Sheva Yehuda, she yishara b'mizrach, they should be in the east. Uhu omer efshi ela b'darom, I actually wanted to be in the south. V'chen Reuven, v'chen Ephraim, v'chen Sheva b'Sheva. Each Shevet is going to come and complain to me, actually, I want it to be in this location. His location is better. Why can't I be in the front? Why can't I be in the middle? Why is he closer to him, etc.? So Moshe says, Hashem, what am I going to do? They're all going to start fighting. Hashem says, Amar Lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Moshe, mach paplecha, lach, ein sarich, ein srichin lach, me'atzman, hem mechirin da'atan, ela, dekati yesh biyadam Yaakov avien hayach l'sharak bat galim. Ah, so Hashem says, Moshe, don't worry. You don't have to worry about this at all. Why do you really care? They already know. Me'atzman hemakirin diratan. They already know exactly where they should be living, where they should be camping around the Mishkan. How? Because way back when Yaakov was dying, Yaakov instructed how Bnei Yisrael should stand around his kever, how they should carry his body to his kever. And the way that his sons were instructed to stand around Yaakov is the same way, says Hashem in the Midrash, that Bnei Yisrael are going to be camped around the Mishkan. Very interesting. And so he says, Kar yesh lahem tchasim Yaakov aviyem. They already have this plan. They already know about this. This is not new. They already know about this from their father Yaakov. So then, according to the Midrash, or at least this pshat of the Midrash, you could say, is Ishal digla, each man according to his house, Be'otot levet avotam, according not to the house of their father, but according to avotam, to their father, meaning the grandfather, Yaakov Avinu. And I think this Midrash, while of course it's a Midrash and there's no real indication that this story actually happened, this conversation between Hashem and Moshe, I think it's highlighting something very, very true to the pshat of Parshat Bamidbar. If we really think about it, if we go back to the end of Sefer Bereishit, from the end of Sefer Bereishit, all the way until Sefer Bamidbar, so Sefer Shemot, Sefer Vayikra, there has been almost no mention of the division of the Shvatim. It has just not been a focus at all. If we actually think about it, the focus, really the focal points of Sefer Shemot and Vayikra were really about the formation of a nation together, right? I think about Ma'amad Har Sinai, that they stood, Vayichan Sham Yisrael Neged Hahar, Kulanu Ke'echad, says Rashi, Ki Isha Echad B'Lev Echad, right? That Bnei Yisrael were camped around Har Sinai together as one nation. That really is the emphasis for sure of Sefer Shemot. And we don't really have this idea of the division of the Shvatim in Sefer Vayikra either. Suddenly comes Parshat Bamidbar, the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar, and suddenly we're really hit over the head with this idea of the division of the tribes. And so in a way, it makes sense that suddenly Moshe is thinking, well, oh my goodness, the last time we had this situation, it was mayhem, it was terrible. The history of Sefer Bereishit is all about this infighting between brothers. And so Moshe understandably starts to panic and needs Hashem to kind of calm him down. And that is situation number three. And I do actually think that each of these situations, and I'll recap the situations. Number one, that first situation, situation number one was about the replacement of the Bechor and the replacement of this egalitarian kind of ideal of serving in the Mishkan. Situation number two was about Moshe and some of the strife and some of the hardships that he had to endure in his family life in order to be the leader. And finally, situation number three, this fear of Moshe that there was going to be infighting among the Shvatim, kind of a civil dispute between the Shvatim. And I think that each one of these stories that's quite subtly presented in Sefer Bamidbar really is foreshadowing to future events in Sefer Bamidbar that happen in the latter half of Sefer Bamidbar that are very much about that chaos that ensues after the Vayihi Vitzor Aharon. And if we think about it, first we talk about that egalitarian society as an ideal, and that really is Meret Korach, right? When Korach says to Moshe in Parsha Korach, we are all holy, kulanu kedashim b'tocham Hashem. Madua titnasu al kal Hashem, says Korach, right? Like, why do you think you can be better than us, Moshe? And that's really what it's about. Why can't we be, all of us be leaders? We're all holy. And I do think that Sefer Parsha Bamidbar is foreshadowing that idea a little bit. Of course, we have the family difficulties, which is of course reminiscent of Miriam and Aharon speaking about Moshe's wife, Ki Isha Kushit Lakach, which we learn about in the latter half of Sefer Bamidbar, which really introduces this tension within the family, this tension between Moshe, Aharon, and Miriam, that I think is foreshadowed here in a subtle way in this parsha. And finally, the fighting with the Shvatim, I think we start to see some introduction of it where there's divisions in the Shvatim. And different Shvatim have different opinions. We understand in Sefer Bamidbar, later on, we have Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven who asked to go on to the other side of the Nile, to camp elsewhere. We have the 12 Meraglim who come and give different accounts of Eretz Yisrael. But of course, this also really is foreshadowing what we know to be the history of Bnei Yisrael, where eventually there's going to be infighting that we learn about in Sefer Shoftim. And of course, eventually in Sefer Melachim, where there's complete division of the Melucha, complete division of our kingship, so much so that we eventually lose 10 of those tribes. And already in Sefer Bamidbar, at least through this Midrash, Moshe is already alluding to a fear of what it's going to look like when we separate the tribes out and when we don't treat Bnei Israel as one whole nation together. And so if we think back, if we think about Parshat Bamidbar as a whole, really, it really does, I think, have this tension between order and chaos. I don't see the Parsha as all order. I see that there's just beneath the surface an introduction of some of the cracks that are forming within Bnei Israel. And I think I always like, I'm a psychologist, so I think about different psychologists, but Steven Pinker, he says, the ultimate purpose of life, mind, and human striving is to deploy energy and information to fight back the tide of entropy and carve out refuges of beneficial order. So says Steven Pinker, and this is, a thesis of many, many thinkers, many philosophers, that really our world really tends toward entropy. It tends toward chaos. That is the nature of our world. And it's human nature to try to put order on top of that chaos. We see that a little bit now in Parshat Bamidbar. And really what our goal in life and one of our, really what we're charged with is, as Steven Pinker puts it so nicely, is to carve out refuges of beneficial order. Meaning what is the right type of order that we can impose upon the chaos that's obviously going to come because our world always tends toward chaotic events. And I think what's interesting is that even within the order of Parshat Bamidbar, we notice that there are still internal struggles within the order. Famously, Parshat Korach talks about how Korach, who comes from Mishpachat Kahat, the Kahati family in Shevet Levi, rebels against Moshe and Aharon with Datan and Raviram, who are from Shevet Reuven. And Rashi nicely comments, famously comments, he says, Oy l'rasha, oy l'shchena, that those who are neighbors with each other influence each other, and they can influence each other in a good way, and they can influence each other in a negative way. And so I think about this a lot with Steven Pinker, that it's really about beneficial order. How do we really impose this beneficial or this desirable order over the chaos that obviously ensues? And I don't want to leave us with, I don't want to leave us on this really down note. I do think if we go back to that last midrash that I talked about in Bamidbar Rabbah, what's so important about it is that while Moshe was really nervous, he was really nervous about the infighting that would ensue between Bnei Israel, Hashem says, calm down. It's okay. We already went through this in Sefer Bereishit. Don't worry. They can take care of it. They can work this out. Hashem really, in this midrash, has this belief in Bnei Israel that they can really come together. And it reminds me a lot of the Haftorah for Parshat Vayigash, I believe, in Yechezkel Perek Lamed Zayin, where Yechezkel, symbolically, he takes two different staffs, one that represents Yehuda and Binyamin, and one that represents Ephraim and the 10 tribes, and he puts them together. And he says, V'daber alehem, k'amar Hashem Elokim, hine ani lokeach et bnei Yisrael miben hagoyim, asher halchusham, v'kibatzti otam misavi, v'heveti otam el admatam. So I'm going to gather them together, I'm going to bring them to their land. V'asiti otam l'goy echad ba'aretz b'harei Yisrael, u'melech echad yiyelu kulan l'melech, So says Hashem through Yechezkel that really in the end we can, there's a belief that we can really bring Bnei Israel together under the right conditions though. And I think it's beautiful and interesting how Yechezkel so beautifully evokes our parsha. What does he say? I'm going to make with them a peaceful covenant. I'm going to place my sanctuary inside their midst, within them in the middle. And my mishkan will rest upon them. Really beautifully evoking that idea of the mishkan residing in the middle of Bnei Israel. So if we are able to really strive for that desirable or most beneficial order, then Hashem can comfortably and for eternity reside in between us, among us, as was that original plan for order in Sefer, in Parshat Bamidbar. So that's all I have for today. Thank you so much. Shabbat Shalom. I'm going to check the chat. I know one second. Let me stop sharing my screen.
People can ask oral questions.
Or you can ask oral. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
I don't see any things in the chat except for my little comment to you.
Okay. Fantastic. So if anyone has any questions, feel free. I don't know how to stop sharing. What did I do?
I have a question.
I'd like to know, are you claiming that the lack of genealogy of Moshe Rabbeinu is because he didn't have a family, because he had problems with his family, as opposed to Aaron? Did you say that?
Well, I don't know that it's that he absolutely had a family. We know he has two sons. Hang on.
They were deadbeats. They were deadbeats.
Oh, here, I see. Stop share. Yes, so I think that there are midrashim that really do criticize, or not directly, but at least talk about that Moshe was not able to teach his sons Torah in the same way that Aaron was able to raise his sons. And I think that what we take away from that is that there are real sacrifices to be made by being the leader. I mean, if we think about our leaders, like David HaMelech, for example, he was an excellent leader. He had great leadership skills, but his personal relationship with his family was incredibly fraught. And we really, really see that. His leadership abilities were excellent, but the personal relationships he had were incredibly difficult. So I think we see that in some of the other leaders of Bnei Israel, and I think it's a fair thing to say.
And are you attributing the lack of genealogy for Moshe Rabbeinu to that fact, to that problem?
Oh, that he wasn't able to teach his sons?
Well, basically they didn't come to anything.
That they didn't what?
Well, I mean, one of them was a leader in idolatry.
Ah, interesting. Okay, that's an interesting midrash as well. I think there are those who would also counter and say that there was a danger in Moshe's leadership being passed on to his sons, and it would be too much like the establishment of the monarchy, and that this like holiness of Moshe needed to stay just with Moshe, and it needed to be passed on to somebody who was not a family member at all, not even part of Shevet Levi, but part of a different Shevet, and that there would have been a danger to that being passed on through genealogy from father to son, father to son. And we see some of that fear kind of evoked in Sefer Shoftim, when Bnei Israel approach Gidon, for example, who was a Shofet, and they say, would you be our king? Please be our king. We want your son to be our king and his son to be our king. And Gidon gets very offended. He's uncomfortable with this idea. And he says, like, Hashem is our king. If I become king and then it's passed on from generation to generation, that's going to be, there's a great fear there. And it kind of hangs, that fear of that genealogy, that monarchy, it hangs over Bnei Israel, even through Sefer Shmuel, where Shmuel is also very worried about that idea, that there's a danger of like serving this lineage, this family. I don't know if that's directly answered your
question. No, my question was, you think this is the pshat in the absence of Moshe's family? Are you claiming that? Because I've never heard that before, and I think it makes a lot of sense.
I think there is. I think there's a pshat. Yes, I think that there is truth in the pshat here. There's no question that his family is largely absent from his life. Yeah.
Thank you.
That's an inflammatory thing to say.
You've suggested that there is some foreshadowing of the kind of rebellion that we're going to see later on, because as an example, the tribe of Reuben loses their status, right? Mm-hmm. Before and so on. So do you see any foreshadowing of the problem with the spies? Do you see anything in the text? Mm-hmm. As an example, you know, we see the leaders who are named here. And I have to admit, I don't recall whether these are the same leaders. They're not, as my recollection is, but none of these are the leaders that end up as being the spies that go.
It's an entire traverse
the land. Set of that have something to do with it. Is that a foreshadowing in some sense? Or you see, there's a simple understanding of the arrangement of these tribes, because if you look at the numbers, the three tribes that are going with Judah, they're the largest.
Mm-hmm.
So they're the front flank in a war. And the tribes on either side are the next largest in terms of their total manpower. Mm-hmm. So if you think of a wedge, this is the strength of the front of the wedge and the two sides of the wedge. And the three tribes at the very back are the weakest.
Mm-hmm.
So from a military perspective, this arrangement makes sense. This understanding that this is from Yaakov's burial is a fascinating one. Mm-hmm. I'd never heard it before, but it's a fascinating one. But you have both. But I guess I'm sort of asking what is being foreshadowed here among the various things in terms of the underlying the order that you see.
Mm,
and you pointed to one, and maybe there's some other things.
A minute.
Yeah, go ahead, Gerson. Go ahead. Oh, okay. Well, I think you bring up some really interesting points. I think that one of the things that's so interesting about the actual order of the tribes that you were talking about is that there's obviously military strategy there. And it is fascinating that the leaders, the Nesi'im we see here, are not the same leaders that are sent to Lachkor Ha'aretz to be the spies in Parshat Shlach, which is really interesting. And I think there's also something to be said for Moshe feeling like the Nisi'im served their role, but they weren't those like inspirational leaders that he needed. And there may have been some mistakes, right? Because Moshe was the one who kind of was at the forefront of that mission, according to, there's different interpretations depending on the Sefer Dvarim account versus the Sefer Bamidbar account. But it seems that Moshe at least was wanting this mission to take place. So I think that's interesting that it's different leaders, like you're saying, but also that the formation of the tribes, with Yehuda, like you said so beautifully, being in the front, there was military strategy there. But if we think about it in the context of the Midrash, the fact that Yaakov, according to the Midrash, places Yehuda at the front and does not place Reuven at the front. Reuven is actually his Bachor, is the firstborn, but he's placing Yehuda in the front. And obviously, according to the Pshat, Yehuda is in the front of the camp, and that's how the camp travels. We are already seeing this shift from Reuven being the Bechor to Yehuda being the Bechor, and then Yehuda eventually taking over as kind of the monarch, right? The everlasting monarch of Bnei Israel. And we're starting to see that kind of feeling or that, is becoming the leader, so to speak, as a tribe of Bnei Israel. So I don't know if that helps with some of that foreshadowing a little bit, but I think that there's something there, even in the arrangements of the tribes, of how the tribes eventually take on different leadership positions once they enter the land.
My question. Mm-hmm. At this point, we are trying to form a nation and go into Eretz Yisrael, mm-hmm, and conquer the land. Why so much emphasis on the Shvatim, which does not help for the unified nation?
Mm. Beautiful. That's a beautiful question. I think that really goes back to the idea of how do people generally feel a part of something, right? And Bnei Israel start off, they're a large nation, right? There's a lot of people. And so when we have smaller groups, I think like from a psychological perspective, when you're part of a smaller group, then you're inherently more invested in what that group stands for and what they're doing, right? Just like I will care probably on a daily basis, I care more about my neighborhood policies and my neighborhood politics than I do about the politics of like Georgia and certainly of all of the United States, right? They affect me more on a personal level. So I'm going to work harder in my small like DeKalb County where I live in Georgia than I will on some of these other more, you know, national kind of issues. And I think that by setting up tribes like that, we're setting up the individual for greater success. I do think there's something inherent about that people really feel more invested. And it's like that, like if you go to camp, right? Everyone doesn't like sleep in one huge matnas. Everyone sleeps in bunks and they feel this like alignment to their own personal bunk. So what you're saying, Chava, is true, that while ideally it's nice to be part of Bnei Israel, in reality, the individual responds much, much better to feeling part of a communal kind of smaller group, feeling that allegiance. And we also talk about, there's a fascinating book, I don't remember who the author is, it's an Israeli book, and he discusses how even now, if you go to Israel, I'll find his name if you're interested, but even now if you go to Israel, the different parts of the country and the different topographies lend themselves very nicely to different miktza'ot, to different jobs that different types of people might have, that very much align actually with what the Shvatim did way, way back in the day when they entered into Eretz Yisrael. So this idea that each Shevet maybe took on its own area of expertise that they were able to develop and be proud of, could then allow us to come together as a much stronger nation. Even a small nation, we were much stronger because each Shevet, each area of Eretz Yisrael had its own area of expertise that they were able to develop.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's...
We have it in the United States with the state.
Right, exactly, right. And there's a lot, right? There's a lot of philosophical thought about state governance versus federal governance that I'm learning about as a Canadian. But we have it with the provinces too, right? There's provincial, and it's there is something to that, not just being part of one large nation, but feeling like you have some community membership.
You got a point.
You know, Rebecca, it's the Ontario election is today. As soon as you finish your share, I'm going to go see. I assume Doug Ford's going to win again. But
really? I did not know that. That's
so you didn't know? Your parents didn't tell you it's the election today. Yeah.
Really
provincial election. We had our federal election a few months ago. There you go.
That I'm following.
But if I'm, you can vote probably. No, you can't vote. You're not a resident. You can't vote. You're right. It's not like the U.S. and citizenship. But, you know, it's interesting. Just to pick up what you mentioned before on hereditary and, you know, you're on the. So I, towards the beginning when we went on Zoom, so Zvi Grumet gave a great share on leadership. And he talked about the four models of leadership, if I remember it correctly. The Melech, the Kohen, the Shofet, and the Navi. These are the four models. And he discussed part of what he said is the Melech and the Kohen are hereditary, right, in theory. The Kohen for sure, but also the Melech, who Banav, should be there, whereas the Shofet and the Navi are totally non-hereditary positions. And the Torah wanted to have both models because sometimes you want hereditary in certain fields, you know, sort of a stability. But obviously, from a talent point of view, hereditary is not a good system. But anyways, that was part of his share because they were talking. So the four different models of leadership divide up that way. But if I may.
Beautiful. All right. Absolutely.
Yeah, I'll have to find them. Now I have to find the Erica Brown 24-8 that you referred to earlier. You know, that was
right.
Yeah. Yeah, you also did one of the 24-8s, but anyways, very nice. Okay. Any other questions? Otherwise, we'll let Rebecca go. I don't know if you're all ready for Yontif. Okay. I hope the kids are sleeping, though, by the time.
I will check.
Okay. Thank you very much. Good Yontif. Enjoy. Good Shabbos. Good Yontif. Okay. Tomorrow morning, please God. And for those who prepared, not prepared, you can prepare while you come to the share. Not my share, 9:35 a.m. in the morning on the Seder. Obviously, there's no share Sunday or Monday. I will send out an email soon. We actually have four new courses beginning. They are, I believe, posted on the website. We'll send us an email as we sort of put together our post Shavuot programming. Some will be ongoing, of course, and some will be new series starting. So if you go to the website and you cheat a little bit, you can begin registration for some of our upcoming classes. Next week, Daniel Lasker will be starting a 3-part series on Karaite Judaism. He's the world's expert on Karaism. He just published a book. So he'll be giving a series on Thursday, and Shuli Mishkin will be starting a series also. They'll actually back to back on Thursday. And then following week, more stuff. We always have good stuff coming up. So I'm looking forward to learning with you. And as always, please invite a friend. And look forward to seeing you soon. Okay, Rebecca, regards. I'll say, and thank you. Thank you very much always for a wonderful share. And be well. Thank you, everybody. Laila Tov, we hope to see everybody soon. Bye-bye.
It was wonderful. Breathtaking. Thank you so much.
Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, Tova. It's good to see you.
Tova, you're Esty, you know. Yeah, I don't know if you realize you're Esty now. Oh, you froze. Okay.
Yeah, I was wondering who that was, too.
Yes.
Well, like a voice.
We were once on something. My name. Anyways, yeah. Chag Sameach, Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom, everyone. Bye-bye.
I loved it. I want to thank you so much. It was really good.
Thank you so much.
One little afterthought. What you said about the replacement of the Bechorot with Levim, it's supersession, a problem which has bothered Jews in different contexts, isn't it? It's about supersession.
Yes, beautiful. Beautiful, yes.
Thank you for inspiring that thought.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your comments. I appreciate them all.
Okay. Laila Tov, everybody.
Thank you.